There is certainly no shortage of books telling us how to make money, save money, and invest money. Author Faraz Ansari asks a somewhat different question. What is the money actually for? Drawing on his experience in wealth management, he argues that financial wealth by itself just isn't enough. His book, The Wisdom and Wealth Solution, Unlocking the Secrets of Happiness, Purpose, and Financial Security, ranges from stocks and bonds and investment strategy to happiness, relationship, purpose, and even the assumptions we inherit about what constitutes a successful life. Good morning, Faraz, and thanks for joining me this morning.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Faraz, let's start with the title. I think most people hear the term wealth and they know exactly what it means, or at least they think they do. But you argue that we've defined that term much too narrowly. What are we getting wrong?
I think most people consider that financial wealth, if they have it, it will bring them happiness, it will bring them meaning, it will bring them purpose. But I have now been working with very wealthy families, very successful individuals, and some very accomplished students. When what I have seen is that when people are able to accomplish financial wealth and they have the money that they were targeting, then at the end of it, they feel something is missing. And what I have found is that financial wealth or money is only one side of the currency. We need total wealth. And I define total wealth as you need wisdom wealth and you need financial wealth. You need to have both in order to live a examined, meaningful, purposeful, joyful life. So wealth is two currencies, not one. Wisdom wealth and financial wealth. And don't get me wrong, without financial wealth, it is very difficult to curate wisdom wealth. Because if you're hungry, it is very hard to be happy. If you do not have, if you're worried about rent, it is very difficult to develop deep relationships. So both are important, wisdom wealth and financial wealth. And that is total wealth.
And I guess that's what makes this book different than so many of the other kinds of books, financial books that I've come across. Financial wealth, I guess, is relatively easy to measure. I can look at a balance sheet. I can look at a personal income statement. But how do I measure wisdom wealth? How do I know whether someone is rich in wisdom wealth?
I think this is something that people find inside. This is something that people will know when they get there. And most people do not pursue it. Most people do not seek it because they're not aware of it. And one reason why we lack awareness is because I propose in the book that each one of us is born inside a concrete box, and we spend most of our life inside that concrete box. And that restricts our vision, that defines success for us very narrowly based on what our concrete box is telling us. And that sort of restricts people in terms of getting to their own authentic truth. So in order to be able to recognize that you have achieved wisdom wealth, we have to be able to recognize and then be able to step outside our concrete box. And that's the point when we have achieved a degree of wisdom wealth.
So let's take a step back. I did find the concrete box concept sort of unique in the financial literacy books I've read. What do you mean by a concrete box? What does that mean?
So by the concrete box, I mean that it is when we are born, right, we are born into a particular family. We learn a language of our family. We imbibe the culture of our society. We inherit sometimes the religion of our parents. We seek the goals of our friends. And then on top of all that, the genetic and biology that is written in our DNA, all these are influences that tell us, that sort of create a concrete box around us. And this box sort of, again, restricts us from pursuing our own authentic truth. And on the outside, this box is concrete, but on the inside, it's comfortable, it's laced with satin because it's familiar. It gives us that sense of security, but it also restricts what we pursue. It defines success for us, which is not authentic to us. So this is the concrete boxes, the religion, the politics, the language, the culture, the definition of success that we inherit from our environment, and we never question, we never ask, and that is the concrete box that I'm talking about in the book.
So what you're saying is there's a disconnect between the sort of notions of success that we develop from all these instances and what the notion of true success that would be satisfying to me as a person would be. It's that disjunction, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I will also share a very interesting story. In my graduate class at UC Irvine, on the first day, I asked this question, that consider or imagine that you are now 60 years old and you have two choices. You get a Nobel Prize or you get 20 million. And I said, okay, which one are you going to choose? And initially, I was always surprised that between 95 to 98% of the people, of the students, they choose 20 million over a Nobel Prize. So I say, oh, who cares about curing cancer? Or who cares about finding or discovering a parallel universe, right? 20 million is more important. But that comes from the concrete box, because we believe that money is meaning, right? And if we have 20 million, it is going to give us financial security. It is going to give us peace of mind. It is going to give us status, and it is going to give us happiness. So that's the concrete box. And that's what people believe, that money will sort of allow them to achieve all these things.
And I guess in your practice, the various people that you've encountered, I take it you've obviously encountered a number of people who sort of won the financial game. They have the money, but they're not particularly happy.
Absolutely. I think we have clients that have tens of millions of dollars, and the clients that have fairly limited resource. And the client that has a lot more money is not necessarily happy. And I would say that beyond a certain point, money does not add to a person's happiness. Up to a certain point, it is important, right? We need to be able to cover for our basic expenses. And I said earlier, you can't be happy if you're hungry, right? Or if you don't feel secure, it's really hard to develop deep relationships. So money is important. But money has a relationship with happiness up to a point. And at some level, I would say that money can even become counterproductive, because then you have issues in terms of legacy challenges. If you have too much wealth, then your kids may not be motivated or your relationships are impacted. So money has tremendous value. Money is needed, right? Money provides financial security. But money should not become golden handcuffs or iron shackles, right? We have to be able to curate money to a point where it gives us the freedom, but does not turn into golden handcuffs or iron shackles.
I'm still thinking about your Nobel Prize question, and I'm thinking about whether or not, and this sort of goes to the concrete box, which is how much of our desire for wealth is really a desire for status. And that some people can't see that the status for the come from a Nobel Prize might be far more rewarding.
Yes. So there is this idea that all humans are playing a status game, and they are either playing a dominance game, or they're playing a success game, or they're playing a virtue game. So the idea is that all humans are sort of playing these games, maybe all of them at the same time. And you're very right that a Nobel Prize is something that can add to a person's status through demonstrating success or through demonstrating virtue, right? So as you made a very good point, which is that a Nobel Prize can be more meaningful than the $20 million because of the virtue status that a person can get or the success status that person can get. But we don't see it that way. I think in our society, it's all about money, right? And that is because of the concrete box that we are born inside of, and that's because of the concrete box that we continue to inherit.
And of course, I suppose there's a tension, because some of the things that are the characteristics of the so-called concrete box are valuable. I mean, they might represent accumulated wisdom. How do you distinguish those from the ones you want to sort of bust out of?
So I think the idea is that we will always be inside some sort of a structure, because that structure is our identity, right? It does provide us security. What I propose in the book is that we should be able to carve windows in our concrete box, to be able to build a door, that we are able to see beyond our truth, beyond what was told to us, and to be able to know or to be able to question why I believe what I believe. And the book starts with the chapter on religion, and there was a big discussion whether we should start a sort of a financial book with a chapter on religion. But my thing was that religion, it can provide meaning and purpose and relationship and community. But if we do not recognize where our religion came from, why did we choose a particular religion, right? Then it could become a concrete box. It could limit our vision. It could take away empathy that we have for people who practice a different tradition. I say in the book that at the core, all religions at the core are talking about love and peace and justice, right? Those are the ideas at the core of all religions. Now, in terms of, but if we believe that our rituals is the only ritual that can lead us to heaven, or that could lead us to becoming one with Atman, or to be able to get to paradise, right? And other rituals have no value, and no one can ever find redemption if they're not practicing my religion. I think that becomes a wall in your concrete box. So religion has meaning, has purpose, and has been around for thousands of years, right? And it actually does show us the value and power of religion, that people who do not have a faith, somebody who's agnostic or atheist, may feel that they, or may believe that they have cosmic meaning, they have terrestrial meaning. They're meaningful for their family. They're meaningful for the community. They're meaningful for their country. But people who have faith or belong to a faith tradition, they may feel that not only do they have terrestrial meaning, they also have cosmic meaning. Their actions have an impact on this balance in the universe, that their just actions or their moral actions will lead them to paradise, or will lead them to heaven, or they will find redemption, or they will achieve moksha and become one with Atman, right? So again, that idea. So in the book, I do not say that a particular ideology may not be appropriate. I just want to hold our beliefs with a degree of introspection, with a degree of humility, right? That my truth resonates with me. It brings me joy. It brings me meaning. But I'm not judgmental about other people's faith traditions and other people's beliefs.
And again, it is interesting to have a financial book sort of start by talking about sort of religion. But look, there is this sort of concept, spoken or unspoken, in American society that to be happy, you must work hard, become successful, and accumulate money. Obviously, you're challenging that assumption, I think with good reason. But have you run into people? You run into people in your practice who say, "Look, I've got all the success. I'm not sure what it's for." What do you say to them? What do you tell them? How do you help them start to reexamine their life and figure out how to get to wealth wisdom?
So I think it's very common, and we have already talked about it, that additional wealth may not bring additional happiness. And there is a lot of research, and we can continue our conversation, what actually brings happiness to people. But before we get into that, there is very important positive psychology research. And I've been exploring this idea now for over 17 years, that what brings happiness to people. And you would be surprised that today the consensus in positive psychology is that if we say, where does 100% of a person's happiness come from? What I was really surprised to find is that 50% of a person's happiness is genetic. It's genetic. So if someone has won the happiness lottery when they're born, they're going to be happy, right? Their money doesn't matter. The size of the house doesn't matter. Their profession doesn't matter. 50%, they say, is genetic. Then life circumstances, it's only 10%. The car we drive, how much money we have, the size of our house, the title at our job, all of that is only 10%. Again, the consensus in positive psychology is that the remaining 40% is in our control, and it is determined by intentional activity, meaning how we choose to think, how we choose to act. And within that, there are two ideas that are really powerful. One is relationships, and second is gratitude. And I think if we just focus on those two ideas in terms of intentional activity, we can be significantly happier. We can control our DNA, right? We can, we do not choose our parents. It's very difficult to change our life circumstances in the short term. But what we can change is the intentional activity, and that can make a huge difference. And primarily the two ideas there, one is relationships, second is gratitude.
And so I think it is interesting that this book does, again, a finance book that talks about relationships, because I guess your concept is they are a critical element of creating happiness as part of wisdom wealth. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is wisdom, right? Yeah. And again, why do we chase money, or why do we want money? We want money to enhance our life experience. At the core, we want to be happier, right? And sometimes we may believe that we need a lot more than we actually need to be happy. And even if we have a lot more, it does not guarantee that we will be happier. What we need is, again, a combination of both wisdom wealth and financial wealth to be able to have that joyful, examined, purposeful, meaningful life. Here again is an interesting idea. In the book, I lay out a method which I call the Living 360 method. And this method has four foundational elements. And the four elements are, you start with knowing yourself, right? Everything starts with you and the invisible stories in your mind, right? That sort of, and they could be part of the concrete box. So knowing yourself, recognizing the concrete box, being aware of why you want what you want, why you believe what you believe. I think that's the first part. The second step in the Living 360 method is know the word, right? And I think in this day and age of AI and rapid change, we need to know what is happening around the world so that we can understand the risks that we face as individuals and the risks that our families have and our communities have. And then also be able to understand the opportunities that exist out there. So knowing the world is important for our career, for where we live, how to manage and mitigate risks that may exist from this fast-changing macro environment that each one of us have. So knowing the world is the second part or the second step in the Living 360 method. So the third step, yes, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to, so go ahead. I want you to finish walking through how we do the 360 grid.
Okay. And then the third step is knowing your purpose, right? Again, asking that question, what am I here for? What is the meaning of life? Sometimes you may not find an easy answer, or there may not be an answer, but asking the question itself is very liberating. Thinking about these topics are by themselves valuable. It's not finding the answer. it is moving in that direction and asking the questions is important about meaning and purpose. And the last part is build financial security, is to be able to start early, to be able to invest well, look at ETFs that are low-cost, tax-efficient investments, don't get emotional, have a budget, right? Create a balance sheet, and then create a plan, stick to the plan, don't get too excited about the market volatility. Over a long period of time, the stock market has done well. It is going in and out, getting emotional. That becomes counterproductive.
And is that the biggest investing mistake you see otherwise smart people make, the going in and out?
Oh, absolutely. I think our mind, there is a lot of research which shows that the pain of a loss is three times greater than the pleasure of a gain. As humans, we want to avoid that loss, right? So anytime there is volatility, people sell at the absolute wrong time, pretty much when we are getting to the bottom, because that is when the pain is maximum. That is when people sell. So rather than buying low and selling high, people actually do the reverse. They buy high and they sell low. That is the mistake that people make. And this is primarily due to the structure of our brain. It is primarily the pain of a loss, which feels three times greater than the pleasure of a gain.
If someone evolves their thinking from a maximize my wealth strategy to finance the life I ultimately want, how would their investment strategy change?
So they have to understand where they are today. And I will tell you, only, I think, 37% of U.S. adults have a budget. Only 37%. 63% have no idea where the money comes, where the money goes. So I think the first step is for people to know their cash flow, to know their budget. The second step is to know their net worth, right? How much, what are their assets, what are their liabilities, and what are their net worth? And most people even don't do that, right? Once you have those two documents, then you go to the third step. And then you calculate, or you have someone do that for you. It's not hard. There are a whole bunch of financial calculators out there. And now you also have AI. You can always ask the question that these are my current expenses, right? This is how much money I would like to spend in retirement. This is what I get from Social Security, or what I can expect to get from Social Security. And then you ask, okay, how much money do I need? And then you look at your investment portfolio and see where you are today. Are you on track? And if you're on track, and how much risk do you need to take? If you have more money than you need, then at some point you can reduce your risk and make your portfolio more conservative if that's what you need, if that will help you achieve your life and financial goals. So the asset allocation, the investment strategy comes from this holistic analysis or an holistic evaluation of where we understand our current position, and then develop a plan of how we want to get there. And both of them have to work together, and we have to have the right level of risk. So sometimes, as you said, as you asked, which is that we do not need to take risk that is not needed for us to achieve our life and financial goals. So it's a holistic process that people should engage with and undertake to be able to get to the right answer.
The book is The Wisdom and Wealth Solution. We've had the pleasure of speaking with author Faraz Ansari. Faraz, thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. I really enjoyed our conversation. So thank you so much.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money Podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.